Okay, so we're now recording, and we have Kevin Whitfield here and Laura Hankins, so a bit of a shorter group than usual. But before we start, there were a few announcements that Richard wanted me to cover. The first is the written comments for the advisory group are due this Friday for the outstanding reports, which are kidnapping and accomplice liability, so that's this Friday. We do anticipate issuing new reports in the next week or so, week and a half, few weeks. And we are still planning on the August meeting, so that'd be Wednesday, August 1st. And I think Richard has said before that if it turns out that people aren't able to come, it could change. But as of now, it's still on for August 1st. And then Richard will also be emailing the advisory group soon about something about the data. He had some more discussion with the courts and is going to be emailing you all soon. So if there are any questions on announcements?
I know you might not know, but just in case you do or have a guess, what are we expecting and what's going to be the deadline on it?
I don't really know what it would be. I think it might be what, Patrice, the rioting?
I think in the next month you'll have some of the breach of peace offenses. I don't know what else is coming.
And then a comprehensive murder provision.
Okay, oh, so maybe those yeah. Two. It has to be at least the 8 weeks. So that would be what, early September, mid-September?
December?
No. September, okay. No. Okay. Well, but again, like trying. Richard is very good about the at least the 8 weeks that's required by statute, and then I'm sure we could discuss deadlines with him, but I think that's what was in the queue coming up in the next few weeks for okay. New reports.
Early conduct. Friday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, and so for today, it was just continued discussion of the reports that are currently underneath the advisory group review, and basically any questions that you all have. We could start with the report 21, which is the kidnapping, and that would be you. So, are there any questions on that? Yes.
I have a question.
Sure.
Alrighty.
So, I have a few questions. I have a lot of concerns about parents and kids and whatever, and the significant change of making sort of parent relative a defense as opposed to decriminalized within the offense. Since this doesn't purport to replace parental kidnapping in the council, didn't even try to amend kidnapping when they passed the parental kidnapping law. So the defense for a relative is just 2A to D, and I am curious. This is somewhat related to the defense and somewhat just trying to understand the crime.
Yeah,
so I'm on criminal restraint at page 28, sorry. I'm wondering whether with someone who is, that's aggravated. You can't really see it there. It's in the,
it's on the back side.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
Double printed.
When someone is a child, someone is under 16, can you commit criminal restraint A through C? Or is the only way you can do it through D?
I'm sorry. Can you actually commit?
Can you, against a 14-year-old, commit criminal restraint by A, B, or C?
Yeah, so if it's a 14-year-old and I say, you can't move, you can't leave this room, or else I'll hurt you, and the person under 14, that would still be criminal.
Well, but this is not the hurt you. This is just the, hey, 14-year-old, I know you don't like school, here's where you need to be.
And would that constitute criminal
restraint? Is that criminal restraint? Or forget school, just, your mom dropped you off here, and here's where you're staying. No, that's not a good one. Can a 14-year-old consent, regardless, consent or not consent, regardless of the parent?
No. So you can't take away a child. Even the child says, yes, I want to go away with this person.
And if the
and
child
says
no,
you're not going with that person, that would still be criminal restraint.
And if the child says no.
Well, then that would just also just be without consent.
So.
Yes. You can commit. I'm not sure if I'm following what.
Well, so it looks like, so you've made a decision to have the defense only apply to A to D. And my question is, right, you didn't have it apply to A, to A, B, or C for a relative. And I want to know whether a relative can be liable under A, B, or C, and for some reason you've only decided to make the defense applicable to D, or whether you can't commit against a child again on by doing A, B, or C. Criminal restraint.
Criminal restraint. Yes, you can commit criminal restraint A, B, C as to a child. Yes.
So then
so
why...
threaten a child, then yeah.
No. We don't need to threaten. We just... right. Well, we can threaten. That could be one way of carrying it out. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Get in the house or I'm going to give you a spanking. Would qualify. Right? If grandma did that.
Sure. I mean, we didn't. You know, we didn't codify sort of like a, I guess, a parental or familial discipline defense, which.
Well, that would be bodily injury, right? I mean, if a stranger said that,
sure,
get in the car,
sure,
I'm going to
sure,
give you a spanking.
Sure.
Presumably, right? But that could be D, right? Which is, if the stranger doesn't have the parent's permission, then it doesn't matter whether they say I'm going to give you a spanking or they just say get in the car. I'm just trying to, either. The relative defense is too narrow, or, right, or it needs to be more clear that you can't commit criminal restraint on a child by A, B, or C.
So, I mean, our intent here was that even if you are a relative, you can commit criminal restraint, assuming you committed it under A, B, or C. So that even if you're a family member and you say you commit restraint by saying like, I'm gonna hurt you, that can still constitute restraint. Now, granted, we didn't codify any kind of sort of obviously
except
sort of good faith parental discipline cases.
People threaten to hurt kids all the time. That's what discipline is, right?
Right.
So that is the aunt saying, you know, go to your room, or I'm gonna spank you, or whatever. And I might have the parents' permission to do that, but the 14-year-old says, fuck you, I'm calling the police.
Right, so we didn't, I guess here, it's a fair point, we didn't sort of codify any kind of sort of even broader sort of general familial discipline defense here. I don't know if we did anything like some of that for assault either.
But for A to D, it doesn't. I mean, I'm right, do you understand the tension here? That if I say, look, I'm an aunt, I'm a relative.
Right.
So if you charge me under A2D, I'm good. This is a flat out defense. I only have to show I'm a relative.
Right.
And the prosecution's like, ha ha ha, we didn't charge you under A2D, we charged you under A2B because you threatened to spank.
To spank. Right.
And
right.
Am I going down on that?
So I guess we didn't think through, and so in those cases, if there would be again sort of general familial or parental discipline exceptions. So even under like an assault, if like an aunt spanks a kid, could that be tried, could prosecute as assault either? Same kind of issue. I don't know how we address it in assault. But I mean, I don't think we want that to be.
So, and what if I have the parents' permission? I'm here because your parents want me to take you to gay conversion therapy. Get in the car.
Yeah, so that would
not. And the 15-year-old says, I'm not getting in that car. Well, your mom hired me to do this.
Yeah. So that would not be restraint. So it's sort of like, even if it's like you're, a babysitter and the kid says, I want to leave the house. And you're like, too bad, I'm locking the door.
Why not?
You can't leave.
Why not? We're not talking about a relative anymore. Why not? Because you can only commit against a kid under D?
I don't know if this is the idea, but it may be that the person's freedom of movement is sort of subsuming whatever the parent has said. Like, you need to listen to your aunt. And so freedom of movement in that context is freedom within, like, what the aunt described.
Yeah, right. The idea is that children don't have a sort of freedom to consent, full freedom to consent to movement. So if the parents say, you can constrain the child, then that's not a crime.
So it may just be that minors of a certain age, it needs to be language about what freedom of movement is with respect
right.
to minors. Versus
right. That was sort of the intent of the sort of the Part D.
Right. Except that D is an alternative to A, B, and C, as opposed to
right.
the
so
way
the,
of charging.
The concern is even like the babysitter says, "Kid, 5-year-old, 10-year-old kid, you're not allowed to leave." That they'll charge.
Right,
them under
no
A.
playing in the front yard because you'll wander off.
Right.
You've got to stay in the backyard.
Right. Yeah. So the intent was not that would be criminal, assuming that the parents consented to that kind of restraint. So yeah, if the text, I suppose, is not clear on that front, then like we'll definitely have to address that either in the text or
so
in commentary.
Kids should be charged under D.
Yes.
Not A, B, or C. Is that probably right?
Yes, that was the front. I mean, but the idea was that even regardless, that if the person is, generally speaking, is constrained using these other criminal means, that can still constitute constraint. But I think it's your point that there's a number of sort of reasonable cases in which you lack the consent of the child and you're not being, you don't,
right,
don't want
and
it
may
be a
not
crime,
matter.
Of course.
We may not care.
Right, we don't want it to be a crime. That's fair, yeah.
So that needs to be something we would address in the commentary or the text of the statute?
I still have to review the text just to ensure that these sort of cases are not being improperly criminalized.
I mean, as a general matter, right, there's always like a general justification, principle, defense. Now, the problem is that we're, as under our current mandate, we're not set to address general defenses, but like, there is a sort of, like, for, that's where self-defense comes from, right? Like, there's a whole host of defenses which are based upon this general justifying principle. So I know that, like, with in simple assault, there is case law that goes to, you know, when there's parental discipline exception, that sort of thing. I mean, that it would be based upon that idea. You know, I think there's been some challenge, I think, where when they're drafting specific offenses to say, well, you know, right now we're currently not set to kind of comprehensively address general justification offenses, but then still trying to sort of like carve out these like clear situations where we definitely, you know, would want to exclude liability. So I do think there's a tension there because what that ends up looking like from a sort of like broader perspective is that, well, if you see some narrow carve outs, then the sort of like implication would be that in any other situation, right. There would be liability. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, there needs to be some clarity on, you know, what role general justification defenses are. Specifically, if this is the code that were to be enacted.
And there's a big difference between carving out and a defense, right?
Right.
Which is, in the meantime, someone may be sitting in the jail.
Right.
Because they can be charged.
Absolutely.
So we are generally going to have a problem with it as a defense as opposed to a carve-out. But
yeah,
I wanted to understand what we needed to be, what we were tackling, or, you know, is it a comment about it shouldn't apply under A, B, and C, or is it just clarifying? You didn't have that intent, and it's just clarifying.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem you've identified is that for children, they could potentially be charged, given based on the facts, under these other versions, and that potentially creates criminal liability on the face of the statute when we would not want it. Maybe something of the permutations we haven't fully thought through, so we need to reassess that.
Would it
may be addressed through even if it's unsatisfactory, through general justification defenses.
I was going to say, is it worth it creating a different, well, yeah, in any case, I just think the big one is the identification of the specific subsection it applies to creates the implication that
Definitely.
It's a specific
right. Exception
to a general rule.
Well, it sounds like that is something that we will be looking at in a second draft.
Yeah, because again, the basic idea is for A, B, and C sort of are like the core versions of how you would really go about this as to an adult. And we want to specify in D that when you're a kid, even if you didn't do all this stuff, if you just didn't lack the consent of the parent, right? Like, kid come
the
with me here, candy,
you have the consent,
we still want
or
it to.
Or believe you do, it strikes me that you, yeah. Okay. That may be it on still outstanding questions I had on kidnapping. I'd asked some other questions earlier. That's why. I didn't have anything more on remote restraint or kidnapping. I do have an accomplice liability left.
Are there other questions on kidnapping? Kevin, do you have any before?
No.
Okay, so we can then turn to the report 22. Accomplice liability, and that would be Michael. Any questions for him?
You.
Okay, I have a question. I have a few questions.
Sure.
So one, omission.
Yeah.
It's not clear. You cite some cases that discuss having a legal duty to act.
Right.
But it isn't in the way the statute is written or in the commentary. Well, that's our question.
Yeah, sure.
Do you have to have a legal duty, whatever, and we'll talk about what that is in a second, to act before you can be held liable for an omission?
That would be my understanding. And the commentary, I think, says on page 4, an omission to act may also provide a viable basis for accomplice liability, provided the defendant is under a legal duty to act and the other requirements of liability are met.
Where?
That's on page 4.
Right.
Yeah.
Good.
And then,
not sure it's the thing I've underlined.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no.
So which paragraph? Second principle or subsections A? What?
Sorry, it would be the last paragraph, third sentence.
There it goes. However, an omission to act.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right, so there are two examples given in the footnote. One would be a corrupt.
Okay, so it is there. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's our oversight. That's Koch's and my oversight. And what then is, what is a legal duty?
Yeah, I mean, so there's some ambiguity. This was something that I think a lot of time was spent discussing in the context of child cruelty and child abuse offenses. But, you know, generally speaking, a legal duty exists when the court or a statute says it exists. So some duties, right? You could have a fiduciary duty imposed by, you could have like a parental duty. So like, you know, I guess.
So it's tied to what your omission is, right? So in the context
yes.
of
mm-hmm.
child abuse,
that's right.
it's a legal duty to take care of the child.
Yeah.
Presumably.
Exactly.
Or neglect, I should say. So I have a fiduciary duty.
Yeah.
But
so
the
for
liability
so-
comes from whether I have to call the police because of a physical assault.
Yeah. So for example, if you're a parent and you're dating someone, and you know they basically say like, you know, if you let me sexually abuse your kid, I'll marry you. Then they sexually abuse your kid, you could be held as an accomplice for not doing anything, not stopping that person from sexually abusing the child because in that situation.
Right, well, is it because I'm the parent. But
right.
So I'm thinking of sort of other, right, if the duty could, if it could be all kinds of duty and we aren't restricting it, then presumably it's, the duty has to be tied to the omission. It's not just having had some.
That's okay. Exactly right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The general provision on omission.
What about mandatory reporting?
What about mandatory reporting?
So I'm a teacher or a social worker.
Okay.
And I'm a mandatory reporter.
Okay.
And I, what? Know the kid is going to go home and get abused. And I don't report.
So, first of all, the mental state for accomplice liability is going to deal with a lot of those types of situations. So, because remember, you have to consciously desire the person to engage in the conduct constituting the crime. So, if it's not, even setting aside whether or not the person has a legal duty, that person wouldn't be liable for accomplice liability because they didn't consciously desire for the child to be abused at home. So it's there's the legal duty question, but there's also a question of just in general, for anyone to be held an accomplice under Wilson Bay, as codified here, you have to consciously desire the person who actually commits the crime to commit the crime.
Wait, don't I only have to have the mental state?
No, you have to have the mental state required by the offense as to the results and circumstances. So, you know, and those are separate issues. So, for example, you could desire someone to engage in certain conduct, but not be aware that conduct is likely to result in the death of someone, that there's a risk of that conduct resulting in death of someone. So those are separate issues, and then also as to circumstances as well. So, for example, I could lend you my apartment for a date, and in that situation, so for the purposes, because you're trying to impress, woo your date, right? I could consciously desire for you to have sex with that person, but not be aware that that person is actually 14 years old. Right, and
right,
so,
but that's a circumstance.
Right.
So
for results, so for the result, a good distinction would be. So I think the example given in the memo is, so you have the situation of someone who's trying to kill a like on duty police officer by unleashing, like taking down a television that's above them,
right, right,
and
right.
dropping on them,
right,
right. So you could desire for someone to remove a television, but have no mental state as to whether removing that television is going to kill someone below it, right? So the question...
Right, I just want to understand, though. So,
yeah.
So, right, so there's... So I did understand that the mental state gets elevated with respect to a circumstance.
Right.
But as to a result, like the kid is going to be abused,
right?
I am liable for whatever mental state I have, which if there's a reckless or a negligence or something, then my legal duty as a mandatory reporter,
right, but there's still,
makes me liable. No,
but there, okay, so there's still. In some situations, it becomes hard to disentangle conduct from other elements, but there is a sort of basic requirement of a conscious desire as to conduct in the situation. So in what you're talking about, where we're talking, you know, the person going home and neglecting their child, whatever the sort of conduct, that the specific actions that would constitute, that we'd call neglect, you'd have to consciously desire.
Where's
which
that?
That's the in A1 and A2. The person purposefully assists another person.
But that can be by omission.
Purposefully,
and I am...
but it must be. Okay, so let's turn to page 5 commentary. Subsections A1 and 2 also clarify that the requisite assistance...
No, wait.
Yeah.
Where are you reading?
Page 5, commentary.
Yeah.
Second paragraph.
Subsections A1 and A2 also clarify?
Yeah.
Okay.
That the requisite assistance or encouragement must be purposeful. There are two aspects of this purposive attitude that bear comment, quoting to Wilson Bay. First, the defendant must act with a conscious desire to assist or encourage. Second, the defendant must also act with a conscious desire to bring about criminally prohibited conduct. Mere awareness of one's aid or encouragement is likely to promote or facilitate criminally prohibited conduct is insufficient to establish accomplice liability. Then in the example it gives below, it gives the sort of classic situation which the purpose requirement is intended to resolve, which is someone who, for example, sells something aware that the object being sold is going to be used to commit a crime, but doesn't desire for that crime to be committed, merely desires to make the profit. The purpose rule adopted here, just current district, which is also current district law, is that where someone merely has knowledge that they're facilitating criminal conduct, that's not sufficient to render someone an accomplice. You have to consciously desire for it to occur.
So, and just as an academic exercise,
yeah,
here, that would not be the case if the mental state was knowing, because then at that point you could reasonably determine that maybe these are going to be possible outcomes, like the neglect or abuse is going to continue.
Exactly.
And at that point I would be on the hook because I would have some vague sense that's probably going to happen. But it's with purposeful, the move from knowing to purposeful is what gets us that extra layer of protection.
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What?
So, like, sort of the TV example, or like the professor I had in law school used the example of throwing a grenade into a buggy that's moving, and you're trying.
No, I need mandatory reporter.
So, because
okay, so, I need because that's
well,
because
it's,
that,
it's
that is a legal that is a legal duty. Partly because I'm to me, because
right,
this is about the omission.
Right. But I'm saying a lot of that moves on the mental state. So if I'm not, so like for the example, I can have, I like this example because it has like two participants. If I'm throwing a grenade into a buggy to kill one person, I'm trying to assassinate the King of England, but I know the Queen of England is also in the car, I'm acting purposefully with respect to the King of England and knowingly with respect to the Queen of England, and then I could say recklessly with respect to the fact that their kids happen to be in the car and I didn't know that. But it's that purpose, it's like a specific intent with respect to the King that I would lack with respect to the Queen, because I don't have a purpose to like motivate any of the abuse that's going on at the home just by hearing about it and not doing anything. Because my purpose is, in fact, to just not have to deal with the problem. It's a different... The motivation for the omission is different from wanting the conduct to continue. I mean, that's a question of fact, but I think that's the case in the mandatory reporting sense. So if I, as a child, describe to a mandatory reporter some abuse at home, the mandatory reporter's omission is not reporting it, but the lack of reporting could be based on a number of intents on the mandatory reporter. It could just be laziness. It could be not wanting to fill the paperwork. Or it could be a specific intent to have that abuse continue. That's probably not what's actually motivating that particular case.
And if so, then a accomplice liability would be justified.
Right. But I could know...
I really felt like I understood this when I read it.
But so in the mandatory reporting, you're concerned about the case where the mandatory reporter knows of this potential harm to the child, fails to report it, so has satisfied omission liability, and then something bad happens.
Right,
to the kid.
Knows, right? So like the kid says,
right,
send this note home that I didn't do my homework, I'm going to get hit.
Right,
and I know this because every time I've done it before, it's true. I see you come in with bruises the next day. I know this is going to happen.
Right,
and not only do I send the note home for the kid not doing the homework. Or the teacher does, but I, as the school counselor, I don't call. I have this duty and I don't. And so that is purposeful, my omission.
The omission is purposeful.
Yes.
But you are not purposefully assisting someone. You are not consciously desiring to assist the person who inflicts physical abuse upon the child. Let me try to come at this from a different angle.
Hold on. So one second. It is about. It is not. It's not purposeful action that has the effect of assisting. It is purposely assisting.
That's exactly right. And so two things. One, something we've tried very hard to separate in the general part is this notion of purposeful conduct. The way we refer to it as is voluntary conduct.
Willful, a lot of jurisdictions.
Right. But like, you know, and it's worth keeping, you know, whether or not like you move your arm, that's a question of voluntariness. It's categorically different than purposeful as to consciously desiring something happening outside in the world beyond your own movements. And so what we're talking about here is, right, you have to consciously desire to assist the conduct which is resulting in this harm. Well, I think one way to look at this is, what would a mandatory reporting case that satisfies accomplice liability look like? It would be...
You should be hit when you get home, and
right.
I'm not calling.
Yeah. And so, because of that desire, you don't call. It's not enough that you know that they will. Now, the council may pass a crime that specifically prohibits mandatory reporters from knowingly. I mean, this is just a general principle. Nothing stops a legislature from passing a specific statute which goes below conscious desire. But as a general...
Okay, so here's where I am. Okay, so this is... So because the result... Because I can have a reckless mental state with respect to the result, where then do we separate? Give me an example where I purposely assist, so I desire there, I do something to assist, I do something or I omit to do something to assist the commission of the crime, but my mental state is reckless as to a result.
Yeah, so that would be as follows. You consciously desire for the parent to be the shit advocate. But you don't desire that
significant bodily injury.
Or serious bodily injury or death.
Okay.
Right? So, yet you may be aware of a risk that the parent beating up the child, there's a possibility.
Okay.
So that
okay.
would be a reckless
okay.
situation.
Okay.
I think to get at the distinction you're getting at, just take it outside of mandatory reporting for 1 second. I think this is a matter of practice. This distinction most often arises in like intoxicated driving cases. You know, it's like I give you the keys.
I'm the drunk.
You're the drunk.
I'm the drunk.
You're the drunk. Okay. I give you the keys. I want you to take the car to get home. So I'm desiring you to drive home. I don't desire you to kill anyone. But I'm aware of a risk, or if I'm aware of a substantial risk that by you driving drunk, someone may die, that's reckless. That is being an accomplice to reckless homicide. If I'm not aware of a risk, but giving you the keys, desiring you to drive, is a gross deviation. You know, I should have been aware of a risk. That could be a basis for negligent homicide.
Okay.
And that's different from...
But you still have to desire me to drive drunk.
That's right.
If you have no idea.
Exactly. If you have no idea... Well, if you have no idea... If you have no idea...
Or you're the valet. Right?
I'm the valet.
I mean, you don't care about my driving.
Right.
This is, here are your keys, and I stumble out of the bar.
Well, but then I don't consciously desire you to drive at all. Then
right.
That,
right.
And this
right.
is getting
right.
at
right.
the distinction.
Right.
This thought, I mean, this is... It's hard. But that is... Right. Then we're in...
That's sort of a good one because, right, but legal duty is only with omission, right? Like the
right.
bartender having some whatever.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Interesting. Taking the keys away.
Yeah. So the only reason I brought that up,
okay.
Your question about legal duty mandatory reporting still kind of stands. I was just trying to highlight that in most of the situations, you don't even have to get to like the scope of a legal duty because the person's not
okay.
consciously
okay.
desiring
okay.
to facilitate the conduct.
Okay.
As to what a legal duty is and what the scope is, yeah, there's definitely some ambiguity. The general provision on omission and liability tries to flesh out a little bit, sort of like the bases of legal duties. But yeah, I mean, that's just like a general
okay.
area.
Okay, thank you very much. Hopefully I'll be able to pass this on to Katja.
Premeditation and deliberation, which we really want to have come back with murder, with homicide. Are those, if they do come back, are those mental states such that accomplice liability, the way it is currently written, would... require, right, as
yeah.
Wilson Bay says?
That's exactly right. So,
because they're not defined.
Right, so it says a person is accomplice in the commission of an offense by another when, and then we have acting with the culpability required by the offense.
And culpability is.
And then, so if we look at footnote 5 in the commentary. So this is referred to as any other broader aspect of culpability. And then footnote 5 says, for example, if the offense aided or abetted requires proof of premeditation, deliberation, or the absence of any mitigating circumstances, the government is still required to prove these broader aspects of culpability to secure a conviction. So that addresses your point.
It does. It actually completely does.
Yeah.
I didn't look in footnote 5. When this question came up, when Koch and I were discussing it, we looked at the definitions.
Right.
The definitions section of
yeah.
like, culpable or whatever. So... How is footnote 5
yeah.
captured in
right so
something that's defined?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure the definition of culpability is an includes in the general part. It says
okay.
the culpability includes,
okay.
and that is
okay.
culpable mental states. You know, causate. You know,
okay.
a few different things.
I don't remember culpability having a definition.
It
was sort of like culpable mental states. Something. It was sort of written more specifically, but I'll sort of look again. Okay. I think that was it for questions. For me.
Do you have any questions or anything on? So if that's, I guess we would be ending the meeting a bit early, but so to recap, nothing more on kidnapping, criminal restraint, and I guess also on the agenda is the advisory group memo 19, the supplemental materials to the first draft of report number 22. Is there anything about that?
Or the memos? I didn't even have to bring them.
Okay.
That's just the intro, and maybe it had some data in it or something.
I'm not sure what would have been on that, but yeah. So if there's nothing on the substance, then I guess we will go ahead and adjourn early. And again, the next meeting would be on August 1st, unless there ends up being like no one that can come, in which case you'll be hearing from Richard. So thank you very much. I will now turn this off. I actually let Janu do it, so I don't need it. There you go.